The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by ABSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. ABSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to tonight's Money Show. Have you ever wanted to drive a classic car, but you, one, couldn't be bothered to deal with the breakdowns? Two, you really don't want the expense of having to constantly be taking it to an expert to fix? Well, there is a South African who is based in the United Kingdom who has started recreating classic cars, but old Porsche 911s, old Land Rover Defenders, sort of crafting and creating and painfully restoring the sort of glory days of some of these great brands. He got frustrated because he couldn't afford buying the sort of cars that he would like to buy, so he started making them himself. So we're going to talk this evening to our guest tonight, who is the founder of Oshay Automotive. His name is David Lane. Started as marketing, as a management consultant. He merged his firm into an American firm and then decided to do something of a passion project. Tato Mashiko from Sunlab Private Wealth will update us on today's market activity. A bit of a surprising close today, a bit of a last minute rally and a slight improvement in the currency after what's been a very sideways moving week. Rudy Dix from the presidency will join us this evening. I'll tell you why. And we'll chat on politics this evening, because I'm getting a sense of a lot of wait and see. It's a typical sort of month before election thing where suddenly nobody wants to make a decision on anything that could be important, just in case. Is the just in case scenario something you need to be taking into consideration? Picking up on that right now here on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Slowly, slowly, interminably slowly, then suddenly. The elections are just over a month away. Politicians out in full force, looking to convince you that your future is going to be best served by them and nobody else. And I'm looking at the polls and I'm massively circumspect about the doomsday scenarios that many of the polls are suggesting. The only polling that matters is what happens on to the ballot papers when we all go out and we put our crosses in the appropriate areas and we go, that's who I think has got my best interests at heart into the future. And when all of those ballot papers are tallied up and counted, we get the result. That is the only poll that matters. Somebody who watches the minutiae of the process far more closely than most is Daniel Silk. He is, of course, the founder and director at the Political Futures Consultancy. And I love the fact that your brand name is coming to fruition here, Daniel, because it is truly about the potential political futures, plural, that South Africa faces right now.
Resonance with you. Yes, indeed. Our political futures are more unpredictable than ever. And I think despite perhaps your skepticism for the variety of the polls that we've had, and we've had a veritable buffet of polls, the trend lines would indicate that this election result could go in any number of different ways. And the ultimate result menu that we might have are really quite extreme. The results are either going to be I would argue very negative for South Africa. I would argue possibly quite positive for South Africa, or in fact, no change at all, Bruce.
Thank you for your incisive analysis. But that's the reality, isn't it?
But the middle ground. The point is the middle ground option. So I would say this is a one-third negative, a one-third positive, and the middle ground option, which is ultimately not much change to the current scenario, therefore also offers us a fairly negative view. So two-thirds of my potential outcomes don't look too good, and one-third looks a lot better.
All right. What is the most... I'll give you a view, and you can tell me whether or not I'm massively naive about this. I'm sceptical of the ANC doomsday argument. They've been slower out of the blocks than they have perhaps in previous elections. They've got far more fires to fight on a regular basis. But once the ANC tends to get its election machine moving, it's a massive machine. It's quite an efficient machine. It's quite an effective machine. And it's very good at activating its voter base. Now, it may not get the same sort of support, certainly in the big urban areas of South Africa, but I'm wondering whether the rural support base is going to be enough to take us to one of those scenarios that you suggest, and that is not that much change on a macro level, ultimately.
Yeah, look, I think you're right. The ANC historically do enter the election campaign relatively late. In this case, they've been particularly poor at getting off the starters marks. I do think that their machine at getting voters to the polls on election day is critical, but that's critical for all the political parties. Sure. Each one of them have to get their voters out, because ultimately the victors are going to be determined really by turnout and by how motivated the supporters of the political parties are to physically come out and make those crosses. But look, you know, the ANC support has dropped. It's dropped incrementally for the last 10, 15 years or so. And on a poll of all of the polls that we have, we are looking at a best-case scenario for the ANC at just below 50%. So whatever I think the current outcome, we are looking at a changed political environment in South Africa. The Party of Liberation, no longer the sole power broker within our politics. And a party at below 50%, many question marks are going to be asked, not just about policy direction in the future, but about leadership and about how President Ramaphosa himself will withstand the many pressures, given that he may well steer the party to a below 50% result.
And again, that's best case scenario. And in a world of extraordinary choice that South Africans are going to be faced with, it's been difficult enough for many years as polling lists have increased and increased and increased. This is going to be a veritable smorgasbord of, I don't know, delights, but certainly choices that voters are going to have to contend with when going into that polling booth. And I still get jitters when I go into the polling booth, and I still look at all of these things, and you're still going to be brimming careful because it's a long list and you've got to look for your favoured political choice. And suddenly there's a lot more choice than ever before. And I wonder how significant that's going to be in outcomes. I don't know if there is actually whether it's going to be a good or a bad thing.
Look, I like choice. I think it brings different players into the political process, which is positive. It also brings new personalities into the process, which I like. But I do think ultimately that voters are going to largely coalesce around the more well-known brands. It's really difficult to start a political party in South Africa a few months before an election. Brand recognition and I think track record, positive or negative, is going to play a role in this election. So I do see that we'll see a fragmentation of the larger parties on the fringes. And I think the ANC clearly is going to lose some support. I think even the DA is going to see some loss of support on its fringes as well. Even the EFF could see some loss of support to the MK party, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal. So the established parties are going to see some incremental losses, which offers these smaller new players some sort of entry into the political system. But I still think that the larger players are going to have the lion's share of this result.
So, I mean, again, there's so much to play for, and of course, it's such a significant election, Daniel. The wait-and-see approach that's been taken by large companies, is it appropriate? Is it the sort of... It doesn't feel to me particularly productive, but it's also not unusual, is it?
It's not unusual. I think anywhere in the world where you've got a closely fought election with such extreme outcome scenarios, you are going to have a wait-and-see approach. South Africa could very well see a coalition built, a broad coalition built around centrist political forces that I think would give everybody within the country a much better feeling after May the 29th. But at the same time, of course, a more populist-led coalition could really undermine some of the policy gains that we've seen and even some of the attempts by the Ramaphosa administration to reel in the business community, to find some sort of cooperative efforts on critical issues of logistics and service delivery, if indeed it becomes a populist-influenced coalition or arrangement after the election, that could very well undermine the relationship between the state and the private sector that has certainly been nurtured by Ramaphosa recently. So really, when you look at these outcomes, they really are extreme and they really offer very different scenarios to the South African business community internally and, for that matter, foreign investors externally.
Daniel Silk, you have no idea what a good segue that is into my next discussion. Thank you for teeing it up so well. Director at the Political Futures Consultancy, Daniel Silk. Well, I'm doing a lot of work around decision making and the power of making better decisions and why some countries are flying and others are failing. In the same way as companies with poor leadership ultimately crumble, so do countries. And the crumble doesn't happen overnight. It starts slowly, slowly, and then it becomes very sudden. And you suddenly go, oh my goodness me, what happened? And certainly attempting to fix things is a lot less visible than the collapse and infinitely harder to see happen. We have been assured that there's a vast amount of work going on in the background, that collaboration between government and business that Daniel Silk has just alluded to. And the CEO initiative, and we've spoken to many members of that CEO initiative, has been getting a lot of airtime on the show, talking about the progress that is being made slowly in the background. Well, I had the privilege this week of meeting Rudy Dix, the head of the project management office at the presidency, who very gently chided me this week because I'd not invited him onto the radio. And he said, you know what, you talk to all of them, you talk to the private sector, but you don't talk to us. And so we thought we should remedy this. And on our Money Show Explainer this evening, what it is that the project management office is doing and how the collaboration is going and whether Rudy Dix is as circumspect about as Daniel Silk about the future of the project management office and the collaboration between public and private sectors in South Africa. Just explain to us very briefly, if you would, Rudy, the role that you've been asked to play as effectively, I don't know, the conductor of quite a complex orchestra.
Hello, Bruce, and thank you for the wonderful introduction. I hope it didn't twist too much of the arm. This is the most exciting part. I mean, of course, when the president, started his term of office, one of the things that he's always has highlighted is the fact that we come out of a period of state capture. You've seen the actual decimation of many of the core structures of government, SARS, for example, the National Prosecuting Authority, and many other. But in actual fact, many people actually don't realize that there's been a capacity constraint across government to be able to implement some of the core programs. And the idea was largely for the president to say, look, I want to ensure that we deliver and intervene, but critically that we support government to be able to achieve those objectives. And building that buffer and ability to coordinate from the center of government, from the presidency, is one of those things. And so, of course, employment has been an core part of our work. Of course, during COVID and our COVID response through the economic reconstruction, the recovery plan, one of the key interventions was the launch of Operation Vulindlela, for example, the work that we do on both rail, ports, electricity, water, visa issues, yeah, as well as telecommunications. And of course, more recently, the collaboration. So it's really getting government to work much more faster, to work much more in a coordinated way, and for us to be able to deliver on our mandates much more quicker.
Unfortunately, the destruction is easier to visualize and to witness than the progress made in trying to repair it. And that's one of the great difficulties I think you have, because progress is always incremental, progress is always slow, and progress is always quite frustrating. How are you measuring the progress you believe, and the private sector chief executives and others I've spoken to on the show believe is occurring, although it may not yet feel like it's occurring?
No, absolutely. I mean, let's just take the Operation Vulindlela or the structural reform program. Those are a lot of the focus of getting people into the program. Onto your program. But I mean, for me, if one looks at, for example, some of the work that we've done, let's use energy because that's a good example, right? President announced in July 2022 the Energy Action Plan. We set up the National Energy Crisis Committee. And we then do work around addressing energy shortages, getting private sector to be able to invest in generation, expanding and unlocking rooftop solar, and doing the reform in the energy market space. Now, these are fundamental things that we should have fixed many, many years ago. Sure. And many people will say, well, why did you do it then? Well, things happen for a reason, as you know, right? But the opportunity is here. In the last 3 years, we've been able to see fundamental changes working this way. So those who, for example, participate in the energy market and understand the electricity market and the reform would say, wow, this is fundamental what we've done. Today, for example, we launched the market code. And the market code, for many who don't understand that, is really basically setting out the rules for a competitive market space and moving from what we generally have always known, single buyer, vertically integrated system. Eskom has run that for the last 100 years when it started in 1923. And so these are the kind of things that we need to measure ourselves again. The ability for us to be able to grow the economy, create jobs, and that is done through the structural reform program. But so we can give lots of examples, and that's quite critical for us to be able to see.
Yeah. Is it too little too late here, Rudy? Mm. Daniel Silk suggesting we're on the cusp of potentially big political change, and the future of this project, which has been painstakingly put together, and there's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and breaking of trust and breaches of trust and lots of angst about this, that it's actually fairly vulnerable, and it's politically vulnerable.
Not at all.
In the same way as the NDP, which was championed by Trevor Manuel and was so promising, kind of withered after he left politics.
Not at all. I don't think so. I think the point about putting this in the bureaucracy is the ability for me as a public servant. Elections can come and go, right? And politicians can come and go. The electorate will decide on the 29th, right? The point about it is, how do we institutionalize and professionalize the public service? That's the conversations that we have. And so we clearly plan for, you know, whoever is going to be around, you know, that we want to continue doing that. The risk, of course, is that if it's championed, as it's championed by the president, that it may be if someone else comes in, that, of course, you know, doesn't see the vision that the existing president sees about collaboration and partnering with the private sector and making sure that we can develop that partnership that ultimately is about fundamentally transforming the economy, growing and creating jobs and getting investment growth. I think it's pretty, you know, certain for us to continue that. And so that's why I think elections timing is not always ideal in a bureaucratic environment and where you want to professionalize the ability to deliver on it. Ultimately, it's us as public servants that must do that. And this is just a different way of trying to deliver from the traditional way of, you know, and the orthodox way of running a bureaucracy. This is what we need to do. We need to continue that irrespective of an election time frame. We don't stop this work. This work will continue even in a new term of office.
Rudy, thank you. Very optimistic view from you, and I appreciate you coming on this evening. The head of the Project Management Office within the presidency, Rudy Dix, this evening, giving us his perspective on state reform. And that's the problem. Reform is difficult. Yes, like the complexity of taking something that has been gouged out and deliberately gouged out, where fear and trepidation has been sown, and where highly capable people have been effectively hounded out of office, or just frustrated out of office, or scared out of office. And a bunch of well-meaning people in office who don't have the experience and the skills and are going, we don't want to mess this up. It's a problem. Private sector putting up its hand, saying, let's work together. Seems to be happening. Unfortunately, seeing the progress is glacial.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To Tato Moshiho we go. Tato is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. And I wasn't expecting a positive close on the week, but we had a positive close on the week and a slightly better day for the currency. But it's a frustrating time. And I'm guessing markets, like everybody else in our economy, are kind of waiting to watch and see whether or not they should be more or less confident on the 30th of May.
Well, good evening, Bruce. I think the market definitely has a lot of varying factors to consider, from, you know, the now infamous rate cuts, which seem like they're just not going to happen.
What rate cuts?
Well, what rate cuts at all?
Yeah.
It really is a lesson in the market's inability to forecast and our overconfidence, I guess, in our own abilities in that sense. But that clearly has expired, and now the market needs to find new drivers of excitement for the rest of the year ahead.
I do like, I love British media, and I love, you know, I remember London Brewer, S.A.B. Miller, British insurer, Old Mutual. Today's latest one is British paper and packaging group Mondi. Now, of course, Old Mutual had a dual listing. S.A.B. had a dual listing. Mondi has got a dual listing, South African originated business. It was in the market to try and buy a company called D.S. Smith, and it was going head to head with a company called International Paper. International Paper has won that bid. And what's so interesting today, Mondi share price, on the failure of a deal that was going to grow and expand the business, rocketed 10%, saying, thank goodness it didn't go ahead. Shareholders clearly very relieved here.
Indeed, I think shareholders are extremely delighted at the failure of this bid. And I think if one considers the track record of South African companies buying into UK Inc., one can see that a lot of these bids are indeed value destructive. And this is no different with the DSS bid. Unfortunately, the UK paper market is just not as efficient from a cost perspective as Mondi's mills, which are mostly in Eastern Europe. And so you're buying into a less efficient market and you're paying up for it. So shareholders are definitely not happy with that potential scenario, and hence the 10% rally today that we saw.
Should the CEO of Mondi be putting his name into the jobs market? We have seen in the past, of course, when deals of this magnitude have been either voted down by shareholders or shareholders have been relieved that they haven't gone ahead, that CEOs quite soon after that are reconsidering their futures. I mean, is it that serious in the life of Mondi, or is it simply one of these things where the market thought it was a terrible idea, management thought it was a good idea, and had the good sense to back off and not overpay?
Well, I think it's a positive sign that they have proactively ended their pursuit after their initial due diligence, as they put it. So I think the market may interpret this as saying, well, these guys are still very capital disciplined in terms of their focus on generating value for shareholders. It would be a different scenario if they tried to, I think, persist and get this deal over the line, you know, and only to be pulled back at the last minute by shareholder, disapproval at at a sort of EGM or something of that nature. So I think they're safe for now. They may have learned somewhat of a lesson through this experience, but we continue and we'll take our 10% rally on the day.
All's well that ends well in the world of Mondi on this Friday afternoon. Old Mutual getting its regulatory approval. I don't suppose there was too much concern that it wouldn't. But officially now in the process of launching its bank. Old Mutual's been in and out of banking for quite a long time. Of course, it became the controlling shareholder of Nedbank. Previously, there was an Old Mutual Bank, and then they sold down their investment in Nedbank and raised capital in that way, had their own problems to resolve. Now they're back in the banking market and into quite a cluttered space, an increasingly cluttered space, which is wonderful for consumer choice. But I wonder just how many banks this market is going to sustain into the future.
Well, that is a very good question. How many banks can the market actually sustain? And you mentioned Nedbank. It would be interesting to hear what Nedbank feels about today's announcements. But I think
I'll tell you what they will say. They will say, we welcome competition. What they actually think, they will never tell us, unfortunately.
Well, unfortunately so. Obviously they weren't thinking of the strategy back when they unbundled Nedbank, but it could have saved them quite a bit of time. But I think to from their perspective, you know, they're obviously looking to focus on, you know, the digital banking, and they mentioned, you know, they'll be utilizing AI and technology. But obviously we've got Discovery Bank and we've got Tyme Bank, who are two new entrants. Perhaps Tyme Bank focusing on the lower end market and Discovery on the upper end. So if Mutual come into the mid-market segment, there may be some room there to maneuver. But of course, there are many, many larger incumbent banks. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how all these players carve out niches for themselves.
Tata Moshiko, thank you this Friday evening. Portfolio manager at Sunlum Private Wealth. JSE up a fraction on the day. The currency recovering a little bit of lost ground. It could have ended worse. Oil's dipped back a little below $90 a barrel, despite an exchange of fire once again between Israel and Iran this morning. Gold nudging towards $2,400. An ounce. It's time for Eyewitness News now. Mikey Malapo is standing by. Eyewitness News brought to you by Khalix. Khalix for the businessman who knows what he wants.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
And what a Friday File we have in store for you this evening. I've not been to Northamptonshire in England, but it is a place of extraordinary craftsmanship. I have got a pair of shoes from there, which are in remarkably good condition. 17 years after I bought them. If you buy shoes from that part of the world, you pay quite a lot of money for them. They're much more expensive now than they used to be then. But I've subsequently had them serviced, because you get shoes serviced and they replace the soles and things. It's that kind of place. It is also. But 17 years I've had one pair of shoes. That's amazing, actually. But tonight, the story of a South African who moved to the UK to set up a management consultancy and eventually merged it with a US firm, and then decided to follow a passion, which he calls handcrafted drivable art. I've seen the pictures, David Lane, at Oshay Automotive, and it's recreating cars that are, if you can get them, hard to fix, expensive to fix, and if somebody else has done it, there's no guarantee that you won't break down halfway down the road. So are you building these things from scratch, sort of true to their original, authentic look and feel?
Hi, Bruce. How's it going, man? Yeah, thank you. I suppose we are. We're trying to build them authentically as they would be if made today. They were fine 20, 30, 40 years ago, but I think there's certain engineering elements that need to be redone in them now, and that's what we try and do. But we're trying to take it a little bit further anyway. But, you know, reliability is important, drivability is good, but they've got to look good doing it too.
I have a friend who's got a penchant for driving old cars, and I've always wondered why he doesn't tow a proper car behind the old cars, because when the old ones break down, he can just tow them behind the new one. But he doesn't follow my advice. So these are cars that you build from scratch, replicas, and kind of based on your own experience. You wanted a particular version of the 911. It wasn't available, so you thought, oh, what the heck, let's build one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I suppose, no, they're not replicas. They are original cars. We take classic cars. We take the old original classic cars. In fact, that 911 you're talking about is a 1970 911. So it makes your Northamptonshire shoes look pretty brand spanking new by comparison. And I'd love to know the name of the company, because we're obviously in the heart of the shoe capital of the UK.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we know a lot of them around here. But we're also, because of proximity to Silverstone and all the F1 teams, we're in the middle of car country too. So all the car organizations and companies are based around Northamptonshire. But so we take an old car and we re-engineer it, we restore it, but then we make various changes to it to make it a bit more contemporary and to be able to keep up with the way we use cars in the modern world. You know, we expect higher speeds, we expect more reliability, we expect higher safety standards in them, and we expect creature comforts. And we're able to sort of do all of that with what we create. And we're primarily taking two iconic designs, one being the Land Rover, the Defenders primarily, and the other the 911. Both been around, both iconic designs and iconic shapes. I have a real passion for the 911.
Exactly.
But having grown up in South Africa and farming up in the Limpopo Valley, up near Swartwater, and I believe probably Mark Berry's listening today as well, but one of our neighbors that helps us. You know, that's where we grew up. That's where we farm. Well, I was out there only 2 weeks ago. We only got back earlier this week, actually, where we were doing some game capture and relocation. But, you know, the Land Rovers for us are vitally important there to be able to stay alive. They're an important tool. They help us infinitely with what we try and do, and help us massively with our wildlife and game conservation, which is a huge passion of mine as well. So that was why, you know, it's the whole thing is a passion project, and we're able to take these tools, these elements that are so important to us for working, but also as far as an enjoyment factor goes, and enhance them. So, yeah, drivable art.
And you absolutely very proudly connect the business and the inspiration for it to your South African roots. You're not pretending that you are a German recreating the Porsche 911 or rebuilding it. You're not a British rebuilding the Defender to its grand old status. You're actually introducing African elements into these vehicles as well from a design perspective.
Yes, we are. And in fact, all the Land Rovers are named after African rivers. So we have the Okavango and Zambezi are built and completed right now. We're in the process of building the Sabi and importantly and close to my heart, the Limpopo, because that's where our farm is, on the Limpopo River. So you know, the African heritage is vitally important. It answers a question of, you know, what we're trying to do. It's not a commercial venture. It is about fun, and my African roots, even though I live on Mud Island now and have done for 20 odd years, we go back regularly. I have a little boy, and he is, you know, he needs to know that he's African through and through as well, just like I am, or at least has some African elements to him. So he loves going out to the farm. We love, getting involved with it. In fact, he's just turned 7, but it was his first time driving the Landy, so we put it in low range, and I'm still suffering with whiplash.
And you could never do that anywhere in the UK because somebody would report you for health and safety for allowing a 7-year-old.
Probably,
but on a farm in Africa,
you know,
who's going to know?
Yeah,
I learned to drive.
Exactly,
I learned to drive on a farm at that age too. Now, a bit like South Africa, the UK is, you know, not in fabulous shape economically, but the wealth there is extraordinary amongst those that don't bother checking their bank accounts. And that's a good market, isn't it?
Yes.
Because there are people, especially if you have something that is authentic and in good working order and has heritage, but it has got modern components to it. I think there must be a huge potential market, particularly in that part of the world where you had petrol head central and craft central.
Yes, there is. You're 100% right. I mean, we have, I think, something like 87 billionaires currently living in London. So the highest number of billionaires for any other city in the world. But these people are pretty shrewd with their money. And these cars are often investment potential or have investment potential for the owners. You know, I think back to some of the cars that I was offered only 10 years ago for, you know, they've gone up probably 200 or 300%. So quite a good return on investment, which is what these people look at. You know, if you end up buying a Lamborghini Miura, 5 years ago they were £1 million, now they're £2.5 million, and of course CGT free as well. So that's not a bad return on investment when you've got something that is good to look at, great to show off in, but also equally good fun to drive. And you know, so the investment potential is there, and people take that into account.
It's a lovely story, and thank you very much for sharing it with us this evening, David. What sort of scale have you built? Are you churning one of these things out a week, one of these things out a month? Have you just churned out three or four?
No. Four a year for the Landies is our maximum. I'm not trying to do any more than that, and we're busy with a very special project on a 911. We're taking a G series car, so a late 70s and early 80s car. And it's full carbon fiber. I've got an incredible design team working on that. And I've had to put my crayons away. I sort of got to a stage where I thought, yeah, I can help out. And then when you see the experts and see how they get involved, I've put all those pens and pencils away now and relying on these experts. But it's a lot of fun. We're trying to build it the way we would want it. It is a lot of fun. And thank you very much for having me on your show, man.
It's wonderful. Nice to have you. Thank you very much, David Lane,
excellent,
the founder of Oshay Automotive. I've emailed you the name of the shoes. They don't pay for advertising. We're not telling anyone. Coming up in a moment, the Brutal Biz Quiz, as we like to play, of course, on a Friday evening. This is the chance you get to pit your wits against us as a team. We have concocted a list of some easy, some frighteningly difficult, and one or two impossible questions, and we see whether or not you have been paying attention during the week. And in order for you to participate, to see whether you can outwit, outplay, and outmaneuver the Money Show team, we ask you to give us a call on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. Of all the Brutal Biz Quiz, the process of dispensing chemicals and salt into clouds is known as what? If you're trying to make it rain, it is possible to make it rain. What is that process of spraying clouds with a mixture of salt and chemicals? What is that known as? Give us a shot. 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
Brutal Biz Quiz time on a Friday night. Kennedy from Kagiso just neck and neck came in first this evening. Kennedy, welcome to The Money Show. The process of salt and chemicals into cumulonimbus clouds to encourage condensation to have rainfall is called what?
Cloud seeding.
cloud seeding. Very particular there, Kennedy, absolutely right. The UAE very much in focus this week. Massive flooding. Nothing to do with cloud seeding. Certainly big weather systems over the region, but lots of people connecting dots that not necessarily should be connected. And when prices rise, we call it what? Other than, oh my goodness me, that's terrible. But it's got a special name, a technical term. What is the process of price rises called?
Inflation.
Inflation is correct. Typically, broad measure. We've seen a bit of relief on the inflation front. Prices are still going up far more quickly than is comfortable at 5.3% on average. But it's better than the 5.6% we saw in February. Now, you've got to pay attention here, Kennedy. Nedbank is saying farewell to Mike Brown. Mike Brown is chief executive. He's been there for 15 years as CEO, but is connected through many convoluted mechanisms to Nedbank over many, many years. Mike Brown worked for NBS, the Natal Building Society. It got bought by BOE. Which bank bought BOE? There's a logic to the question, Kennedy. There's a logic to the question. BOE bought NBS and somebody bought BOE. Which was the bank that bought BOE?
Nedbank.
It was a good guess, Kennedy. I think it was a guess at least. It was one of those desperate answers that was quite guessy in its tone. Absolutely right. And no sooner had Nedbank bought BOE, of course, that there was then a run on Nedbank. And Old Mutual stepped in and bought Nedbank. Later on, it sold Nedbank, and today Old Mutual announced it's opening its own bank. Oh, my goodness me. You've got to keep up with this. It's quite difficult. Now, Apple has deleted which Facebook-linked apps from its App Store? What apps can you not get in the Apple App Store that are connected to Facebook?
Now,
I told you we'd catch you. I thought we'd catch you eventually, Kennedy. Yeah, you're doing far too well. Eventually. But it took time and it took effort, Kennedy. It took effort. Well, thank you, Kennedy, very much for being a super sport. And everybody else had dropped off because they thought you were just going to take it to the winning post, but you didn't. So our lines are still open. If you want to outwit, outplay, outmaneuver us as a team, we may very well have stumped you as we stumped Kennedy. It's a devious and deceitful trick. We know this. But Apple has deleted two apps connected to Facebook, which kind of gives it away a little bit, from its App Store. And it's in compliance with an order from the Chinese internet watchdog saying it's worried about national security. Apple has delisted from its App Store in that country. An Apple spokesman has reiterated their commitment to adhering to local laws in all regions of operation, even if they disagree. So you'll still be able to get in South Africa, of course, but not in China. Nobody's nibbling? Nobody's biting? 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. Still a moment or two to get in terms of the final throes of this hour of The Money Show before we go, of course, into the best bits of The Money Show, which we will bring you, of course, some of the great stories that we've covered this week. I'll put you out of your misery. WhatsApp and Threads. You can't, if you are in China, you will not be able to use WhatsApp and Threads this week. One last question for you. The company that is asking its shareholders to pay Elon Musk $56 billion. $56 billion. A trillion rands, South African. And he's still only the fourth richest person in the world, by the way. I think Mark Zuckerberg overtook him this week. Mark Zuckerberg moved into position number three. Elon Musk, no longer the richest guy in the world. Poor Elon. So he needs some cash. And Tesla this week announced that it was going to be pushing ahead and restore a $56 billion deal that it did with Elon Musk. And I thought that Andrew Woodburn at AMROP, Woodburn Man, was very good on this evening, equating the sort of pay deal that Elon Musk did 6 years ago to the pay deal that Chris Becker did with Naspers. Chris Becker took no salary for a long time from Naspers because he'd built MultiChoice and he'd built DSTV, and of course he'd introduced satellite TV to South Africa, then became the CEO of Naspers. And in the early days of Naspers' China expansion, it was, let's be fair, disastrous. And the company, I think it was in 1993, reported its first ever loss. No, it couldn't have been 93. Must have been in the year 2000 or thereabouts. 2001 reported its first ever loss. And it didn't look good for Chris Becker and for the company that was traditionally a print company. company that produced newspapers and magazines. Chris Becker was leading the process of buying Chinese internet businesses, but it wasn't going well. And effectively, it sort of goes down in legend as the last throw of the die was this little gaming business that was needed $32 million and they needed another $8 million of operating capital, and they put money into it. And of course, the returns have been stratospheric, and the benefits for South African investors have been absolutely huge, courtesy of the massive growth in Tencent in China. And Elon Musk's deal with Tesla was very much the same. Don't take much pay, but take some shares, and the share price of Tesla has been stratospheric. And now the company wants to pay him $56 billion. It's what's in the contract. But a quarter said they can't. And now the company's saying, but we must. The problem with the story this week is then it's the same week in which, of course, Tesla has announced it will cut 10% of its global workforce, which is one of those bitter pill moments in the corporate world. Coming up in the next hour here on The Money Show, some of the best bits from the week it has been, including a bit from Warren Ingram, particularly informative this week, plus lots of other good bits from The Money Show. Back with you in a bit.